the peace of Christ be with you. Welcome to Holy Family Radio. This is Deacon Jim Thorndale, and I'm privileged to be your host today. I warmly invite you to enter into another conversation in living the Catholic life. We live this Catholic life many times, and we think we understand all the sacraments of our church and the rules and the regulations and what it means to truly be Catholic. But in our world today, we really have many of us, including myself many years ago, who are stumbling in the understanding of the church's laws. And when I say speak of law, I'm about canon laws and the understanding of how to live fully in the Lord Jesus Christ. And how do we bring that out in Catholics? How do we have this understanding of what it means to live within our Catholic life and to live faithfully in our Catholic life? And I'm hoping today that we have someone here that can really help clarify this understanding of what it means to live within the church and her laws and the love of Christ and what it means to really come to a full understanding of living a Catholic life. Today I have with me Reverend Monsignor Edward Hankevich. He was ordained on June 24th, 1979, and he has told me he was ordained by Pope John Paul II. What a privilege that is. He's a pastor at St. Anthony's Parish in Saranac and St. Mary's Parish in Lowell, and he's also the judicial vicar for the diocesan tribunal office here in the Diocese of Grand Rapids. Monsignor, I want to welcome you. Thank you for being here.
It's a privilege to be here.
Thank you. You know, as I was talking, I thought of all the people in my walk since I've been a deacon who have really had such a terrible time in understanding how the church views marriage and how they view, unfortunately, sometimes the breakup of a marriage. And I'm hoping today we can bring some clarity to that, because I can't think of anybody better to talk about that than you.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
But the idea of giving some clarity is very important. People do have misunderstandings about these things. Sometimes it's looked upon as basically like a Catholic divorce, but it's not.
Yeah.
The church looks upon marriage in a particular way, not only with sacramental effects, grace, the grace of God, but also has very human effects. And sometimes those do not really come into being because of just human beings who are very limited and at times weak.
So. Yes, exactly. Well, before we really get into the understanding of decree of nullity, even the sacrament of marriage, I think it's important that our listeners hear a little bit about you, Monsignor, and what brought you to this point as a judicial vicar of the diocese. That just didn't happen overnight. Mm-hmm. What was your journey to the priesthood? How did that happen?
Well, I was raised at St. Isidore's Parish on the northeast side of Grand Rapids.
Okay.
Went to grade school there. At age 14, I went to St. Joseph's Minor Seminary here in Grand Rapids for a couple of years. Yeah. That didn't work out too well. It's just not ready yet. And so I finished up at Catholic Central in downtown Grand Rapids.
Okay.
Graduated from there in 1964. So we have our 50th anniversary coming up in a couple of weeks. The whole idea of being that old is kind of scary itself, but anyway. And then right after high school, I joined the Navy, and I was in the Navy for 4 years, spent 2 years in Puerto Rico and a year and a half in Iceland.
Okay.
After that, I came back home to Grand Rapids, went to Aquinas College for 4 years, worked a couple of jobs in that particular period of time. Well, Aquinas was always expensive.
Yeah.
And so at one time, even I was working three part-time jobs just to pay the bills.
Just to make the ends meet.
Absolutely. Fortunately, I only lived about 10 blocks away from Aquinas, so many times I could walk.
Yeah.
That helped. Then after Aquinas, I worked for the city.
May I ask, what was your degree in at Aquinas?
I was working on a teaching degree. History was my major, and German was my minor.
But still not a call?
No. It was one of those things where you're kind of fighting God over the years, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I had priests ask me about becoming a priest, even when I was in the service. And I just said, no, I'm just content. Go back to Grand Rapids. By the grace of God, get married, have a bunch of kids, sit in the pew on Sunday morning, and I'll be very happy. Now, and I will put money in the basket, and that's it. But as we know, God always has his own plans. And so in those 2 years that I was working after college, things started changing in my life. And it was really one afternoon where it was some sort of voice or something. I gotta be careful about those sorts of things. In which I believe the Lord was saying, you know, I've got something else in mind, and this isn't it. Okay, it's very strange. And so I just was able to drawn quite a few priests that I knew in the area. One of those good priests is Father Jim Kozłowski, the parish priest at Our Lady of Sorrows.
Yes.
He and I are first cousins. And
you were first cousins?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful.
His mother and my dad were sister and brother.
Oh.
And so it was through that that I eventually got back into the sort of the church's vocational system. I spent 1 year at Mount St. Mary's in Emmitsburg near the tomb of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton. And then after that, I was sent to Rome for 4 years to study. I went to the Angelicum University, which is the Dominican University there. Was ordained by His Holiness St. John Paul II, as you mentioned, the date of 1979.
Wow.
I came back to Grand Rapids. My first assignment was St. Francis in Holland. I was there for 18 months, then went to St. Isidore's for 18 months. And at that point, the Bishop Breitenbeck asked me to go and study canon law at Catholic University in America. So
Additional studying was it?
2 years.
2 years to be a canon lawyer.
Yeah. It's called a license, but it's equivalent to a master's.
Okay.
And after I finished those 2 years, then I came back to Grand Rapids, and I was first assigned to St. Jude's. I was there for 4 years, working with late Monsignor Brophy. Who was a great man, too.
Yes.
Then I was given an assignment up in Sand Lake at St. Mary's, which then became Mary Queen of Apostles, and St. Clara's in Coral. That was followed by a little over 17 years at Sacred Heart of Jesus in Grand Rapids. And then about almost 3 years ago now, I was sent to Lowell and to Saranac. But in the meantime, when I came back from canon law school, I was assigned to the tribunal right away.
Okay.
And it was about 5 years.
The bishop assigns you to that.
Yeah. Right. Oh, yes. We don't do this stuff anymore.
Right, just so that our listeners know.
The whole idea is it's sometimes these things happen because you're standing in the wrong place at the wrong time. And so I.
Keep your head down, in other words.
Oh, yes. 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 You didn't see me. So I worked in the tribunal for all those years. It'll be 30 years. Well, in fact, it's 30 years this month.
Okay.
And about 5 years ago, Bishop Hurley asked me to become the judicial vicar.
Okay.
So it's kind of slid
just
into that.
Explain that, because I know there's adjunct judicial vicar. Explain that to our audience.
Well, as Monsignor Duncan, who was the vicar general of the diocese, says, I'm supposed to be the chief justice of the diocese. That's putting it a little too broadly, but... I just preside over the office. We have quite a few priests that are judicial vicars.
Yes.
And this is a joint effort. It isn't just mine, because I'm more of an administrative position, so I have a lot of the clerical things that I have to do, take care of personnel. But handling cases as the other priests do.
Okay.
And we've got five of them that do part-time work, because everybody's in the parish.
Okay.
You know? I work usually about 3 days a week at the tribunal. And just trying to take care of cases. We are what we call a second instant court for Detroit.
Okay.
So cases that we handle in our first instance, taking care of the people of our own diocese, are sent to Detroit for review. And about half the cases that Detroit does, they send to us for review. So that's how it functions.
Before we get into the specifics of decree of nullities and the sacrament of marriage, who makes the ultimate decision when everything is said and done, whether it is granted?
The judge that's assigned to the case.
Okay.
So it could be one of several of us.
Okay.
So that's the decision, but then it's always sent to Detroit for review.
Okay.
Also, the parties that are involved, we call them the petitioner, the one who seeks the declaration of nullity, and the respondent, the former spouse. If they wish, they can challenge the decision, and also they can appeal it, and they can either appeal it to Detroit, or they can also appeal it to Rome.
Of course. Well, one other question off this was the main subject. All this moving around in these parishes, you know, I tip my hat to your priests and you Monsignors, because it must be hard to have to continue to adjust to whole different parishes. Expectations of people when you come in are totally different than probably what you left, and you really have to almost win their hearts.
start all over again. That's what you have to do, because every parish has its own history, customs, background. And so it is difficult.
Yeah.
You know, some are a little more of an ethnic band, some are perhaps a little more American, some are a little more traditional, some are a little more progressive or whatever.
Yeah.
And trying to fit into those things is not easy.
No, I would think not. I would think not. And I was wrong. I have one other question before I go into it.
Okay.
Priest, Monsignor.
Okay.
I think people listening really would like to have an understanding, because we use that term and yet they don't have a clue sometimes as to what we're talking about.
Well, it comes out of the French, which basically means my lord, okay? And the term my lord has been used, at least in some societies, as addressing a bishop, okay? It's a title.
Okay.
It's sort of like when St. Adalbert was named a basilica about, 20-plus years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a church, and it's a parish church, but it's given a title because of a recognition in that particular case, or because of its history and its architectural finesse.
Right.
When it comes to priests being named Monsignors, it can be because of their office, in the case like Monsignor Duncan, who was the vicar general of the diocese. Mm-hmm. In my case, I was vicar judicial for about 2 or 3 years when Bishop Hurley called me in and said that you're going to be named a Monsignor. And I said, oh, okay, fine. If I may add an
aside, did they increase your pay too?
Well, no, it didn't. And although the diocese was very gracious about the whole thing,
yes.
But I remember when I fully went public about it and to announce that I had been named a Monsignor, I only could think of my father, and Dad had a very interesting streak about him. And I'm sure that when I would have told him, he'd say, "How much is that going to cost me?" It wouldn't it? But anyway, and that's what it is. It's just a title, and some priests prefer not to use it.
Yeah.
But it is an honor it's given by the Holy Father.
Of course.
And, we do the best we can. That's all.
I appreciate that, because I hope that lends some clarity to our listeners on that, too. But so let's turn the tables and let's talk about marriage. And unfortunately, in our world today, some that just don't seem to be able to make it through. And the Catholic Church and her sensitivity and the love for her people, and Christ for the love of his people, has really given us some means of reconciling.
Sure.
But, you know, first of all, let's really go into a definition of what God expects of a marriage.
Okay. We look at marriage as being this a partnership of life between a man and a woman in which they choose without any influence being forced by society or family or whatever, but simply being prompted to be with each other, in which they, first of all, want companionship. They are there for, they want to marry each other for the good of the other.
Right.
It's a total giving of oneself to the other, right, in a companionship of life. And then also the other part is for the procreation and the education of children.
Right.
And those are called the two ends of marriage. And I think we can see that as being pretty basic, even just in nature.
Yeah.
A lot of the things that the Church teaches is based on the laws of nature, and right. This is what we're looking at.
In the Catechism, we call it unitive and procreative.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Right.
And that's exactly what the Church wants held up as the ideal, and to the extent that any human being is capable of doing that, the ideal, the Church is there to help couples to assume that ideal,
yes,
and to live it out for their entire lives.
Yes.
But as we know, and still in the United States, I think the percentage is about 50% of marriages that do not make it. But these are human beings, and living up to ideals is not that easy.
No.
And as we know, even the Ten Commandments, in a sense, are ideals, and we're expected to live up to them.
Of course.
But when we fail, there's also the mercy of God. The Church acts as an intermediary in shedding God's mercy upon us. She has this great instrumentality. Well, the tribunal, in a sense, functions the same way. It is an instrument not just of justice or of rights, and although it does involve that, because it takes two parties to make a marriage.
Of course.
And so they both have standing in the Church to present their case. But we have to, you know, look at them very seriously. It isn't just a question of, well, we had a very nice wedding, so therefore it must have been a good wedding. But what does it take of two human beings, a man and a woman, to really live out that commitment to the ideal, to the teaching of the church, yes, of unitive and creative, takes a lot.
Let me ask you this question. When you talk about 50% of these marriages that are failing, somewhere in my mind, and I consider myself now part of the clergy, part of the church, I feel that in some way, the church has to take a little responsibility. I think when I was growing up, I think there was some lax catechesis about marriage. I remember not really getting ever in much education on marriage and the understanding of the sacrament. And I think the church is stepping up to the plate now and really starting to bring a fullness of the understanding of the sacrament of marriage. Even in the marriage prep, I think we're doing a better job.
I believe so, yes. I can remember when I was a kid and you would look on the cover of the St. Isidore's Bulletin, and I think if you were two Catholics wanted to get married, I think you could give the priest like 2 weeks' notice.
Yeah.
And maybe if it was going to be a mixed marriage, you know, somebody's not Catholic, then maybe 4 weeks or something like that.
Yeah.
But even in today's sort of atmosphere, first of all, I required 9 months to meet with the people.
Mm-hmm.
There's also premarital courses that they can go to, pre-canon courses. There's a couple league. Some parishes do have a couple mentoring
yes.
program.
Yes.
And all those things. And all those are good. And the idea is to get these people who want to marry to really think about what it is that they're doing.
Yes.
Sometimes the problem can be, and I try to do that from the very beginning of my my classes with people who want to marry, that an engagement time is not the time to pick to worry about the color of the cummerbund or the flowers or how long the limousines are going to be.
That's right.
The idea is now is the time to really think about what you said when one asked the other, will you marry me? What is that going to take?
That's right.
I remind them that the vows, usually the conventional ones, you know, to have and hold this way forward for better, for worse, richer, poor, sickness and in health, until death do us part. What does it mean?
Mm-hmm.
It means that I am placing my life in your hands. Don't let go.
Yeah.
But it's done mutually. Right? And I know some people out there wondering, well, how does a celibate guy know anything about marriage? Well, I'll tell you one thing. Working in the tribunal now for 30 years, I think I know some insights into
yep.
marriage. I'm not the great guru, but I see things. And so every so often when I do have a couple, and it happens once in a while,
yes.
where I'll tell a couple after a couple of sessions, I say, you know, there's too much that you don't seem to know about each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then until you come to that understanding, I'm not sure I can really participate in overseeing this great merging of you two.
That's right.
Because you marry yourselves. I'm a witness,
that's
okay?
Right. That's right.
I'm not the priest who married you. Okay, you married each other. But you know, do you know what's really going on here? What is going to be required of you? I mean, nobody has a crystal ball, so we can't figure out what this marriage is going to be like
right.
1 year, 5 year, 25 years from now. But it's going to be an experience that's going to require an awful, awful lot of you.
That's right.
And you cannot build any walls between yourself and the other. If I can cite some examples over the years, and I usually give this to
sure.
a couple.
But I want to dispel two sure. Stigmas that you talked about. One stigma where they're saying you've never been married.
Mm-hmm.
But you've witnessed marriage within your own household with your mom and dad,
mm-hmm.
number one. Number two, Arnold Palmer once was interviewed, and he said one of his best golf coaches never swung a club. Never played golf, but he could analyze their swing and he could tell them how to correct his game. But the man studied golf and knew the golf. So the point I'm making is that you have studied the sacramentality of marriage, the depth of what it means to be married as Christ was betrothed to his church, what it means for a man and a woman to be betrothed. And the grace that comes from that is profound. And young people should be listening to those people who are teaching them about the sacrament of marriage because they have a deep, profound sense of wisdom in what it means for a lasting marriage.
The term wisdom is a very interesting word, because I'm not too sure in this day and age, and I'm making a judgment, and that's perhaps a little too far off the cuff, but do we really do we give credit to wisdom in this age? We are so given to sort of a vending machine mentality, exactly, in life that, you know, I want to do this, and I'm going to get that, and that's it, you know? And if it doesn't happen, well, then the machine is broken, and I don't want to play anymore, whatever. But this, we're not talking about that when we're talking about marriage. Two human beings handing their lives over.
Yeah.
And this is going to take a tremendous amount of effort.
It is.
Just this past week, I had one couple in the parish at St. Mary's. They celebrated 50 years of marriage. Another couple last week, Saturday, celebrated 60 years of marriage.
Praise God.
It can't be easy. It just can't.
No.
You know, I can see it. And as soon as you get children into the mix, oh boy. there we go. You know, you ruin your whole day. But that's the way it is. You know, it's, the thing is that your lives are changed. But even as you change, the Lord's grace is there to help you.
That's right.
To use in some older terms, we used to talk about the sacraments, in a sense, causing two kinds of grace. Sanctifying grace, which is meant to make us holy.
Right.
But actual grace, and that is in order to fulfill our roles on this earth. We have our feet stuck in the mud of this earth.
Yes.
And we need help to do that.
Yeah.
And so when it comes to marriage, you're being given the grace to be a good husband and a good wife.
How many couples do you think see their marriage as a vocation?
That's a good question. I try to, you know, get that across to them.
Yeah.
That this is a vocation. The Lord has called you to this. You want this celebrated in the church, and so therefore there is a presumption that you understand that this is not, the church is not a nice venue, you know, flowers and the candles. No, as they say, a wedding is a day, but a marriage is a lifetime.
That's right.
Well, if you're planning on a vocation, an occupation for a lifetime, you go to school, you study hard, do the exams, go for advanced degrees, all of that, in order to achieve a good occupation in the world. Well, then what about a vocation?
Exactly.
It's going to take a lot out of you. For the most part, you're going to start learn as you go, because nobody can really tell you everything.
No. That had to be true in your priesthood.
Very amen. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Right. That's why, and you had some young seminarians here a few minutes ago, and when they walked out, I told them, well, there they are, the lambs for the slaughter. You know, they have no idea. And it's a good thing that they don't, okay? They're approaching priesthood with a great sense of optimism, that they want to do good for the church.
Right.
It's the dispensing of oneself for a higher good. Well, that's exactly what marriage is, for the higher good, the good of each other.
Yes.
And then also the good that come from children.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it can never be a self-centered endeavor going into marriage saying, I want to be fulfilled. It's got to be, I want to fulfill the other.
Yes, exactly. And if those other things are there, that building walls, this marriage is for me sort of thing, well, then it's a train on a track that's going to head towards a cliff.
Yeah, yeah. And those are, now, I didn't mean to interrupt you earlier. You said you had two examples.
Well, I was just thinking of different kind of examples I've seen over the years where just people kind of venture into marriage without really having a sense of the giving of oneself. I can remember a particular couple that our conversations in the rectory office, he always answered the questions, but she didn't.
Mm.
And so every time I would ask the question of one, I would ask it of both. And so I'd say, well, you know, miss, you know, what do you think about what I just asked? And she would tell me her own feelings about it. But then her fiancé would almost like step in and start saying, well, but don't you want to tell Father X? Mm-hmm. And this kind of went on for a couple of sessions. And finally I said, you know, there's something wrong here, that he seems to be expressing a real dominant role in your relationship at this particular moment in time. And once we have sort of finished, as I said, I'm not ready for this. I think you haven't done enough of real sharing of your lives so that you can be free enough to allow the other one to express themselves, because you're going to have to do that in marriage.
Yes.
And so we finished up, and I said, well, I think you need to go home and do some thinking. And so as they were going out the door, I was talking to the lady, and I said, you know, do you like that when he kind of interrupts and tries to correct what you were saying? And she said, oh, I hate it. I said, well, did you think that that was going to change once you got married? Because it won't.
It's going to get worse.
It's going to get worse, yeah. You know? And by that time, you've already said, I do, and, you know, you really want to live up to that. But do you want to live in that sort of dominant sort of environment? And we see a lot of that.
Of course.
Which is very unfortunate. You know, the parties are meant, in a sense, to surprise each other.
Yeah.
And when that doesn't happen, if they insist on no surprises, you will do exactly what I want you to do. That's manipulation, that's domination, that's not two people joining into a mutual agreement.
Exactly.
You know, you are going to do what I say. That's not a good thing.
Back, Father Monsignor, when you were you're still a young priest, but when you were a younger priest.
Oh, if you only knew. Okay.
When you were a younger priest, yeah. Was the Form A always the same, or has that changed? Because when I prepare couples now, there are very pointed questions that we ask them individually in the privacy without the other one being there. And they really come down to the understanding of any defects or impediments to the marriage.
There you go.
And I mean, we ask them, you know, honestly, if they can, if there's any duress or if there's any responsibility to another person or all those questions we ask. I would assume the church has really taken a lot of time to think these through because they really can be a key, like you're talking about, to, I mean, that may be something where she wasn't free with him there to say that.
Exactly. Well, those questions, there's a, you know, two sort of columns, and the desirable thing is to actually ask those questions separately.
Yes, I do.
So they're not in the presence of the other.
That's exactly right.
Because
there
are a couple of them. I mean, are there any problems with the misuse of alcohol, drugs, or abusive behavior?
Yes.
And if you do it in the presence of each other, well, you know, of course there isn't, you know. But if you can get them alone, the importance is, you know, to answer these questions with as much freedom as you have.
Yeah.
Because in any case, if someone, if there's duress, if there false promises have been made, sort of thing, I don't think it's too much of a problem anymore. But I use the example I give when it has to do with, is there a condition to this marriage? Like, for instance, well, if your grandfather doesn't kick off within 6 years and leave you all the money, then I'm going to leave you.
Exactly.
It's kind of crazy, but sometimes people do look beyond this other person and see just, you know, a bank book or something.
Exactly.
And they may sound like something old-fashioned. People don't do that anymore. It's still happening.
It does. It does. I can speak for it also because I've been preparing couples now for 8 years, and I've seen some things that I think, you know, this is really not going to be healthy if this continues on.
When I started 30 years ago, I didn't think about it that much, but I thought, well, you know, the church is changing and evolving and trying to make a better time for preparing for such an important thing as marriage. And I'm sure that with PMIs, premarital inventories, and those sort of things will get better.
Yeah.
But human beings are still human beings.
All the time.
And we're making the same mistakes over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And so the tribunal is there then to, once a marriage has imploded, they've gotten a divorce, is to invite the two parties to really look critically at their own lives and to see what did it take to go to get to married in the first place. Was it just a spur of the moment sort of thing? And even though in the years since that time, we expect them to be preparing for a longer period of time.
Of course.
No amount of time is magic.
Exactly.
Ultimately, it's what the couple does once they are living together as husband and wife.
Yep.
But we expect some things to be done in advance. Ask questions.
Yes.
You know, well, one of the things, the great things about the premarital inventory, and it doesn't happen too often, but every so often I will have the results in front of me. And I will say, well, you, the groom, you said that, you agreed to it, but you, the bride, disagreed. And once in a while they say, but I didn't know you felt that way about that. Well, but you never asked me.
That's
well,
right.
I know, but I thought we just kind of presumed. Oh, you presumed. Oh, bad.
That's a bad one, isn't it?
Bad one, you know? And so the idea of if you're going to be taking these nice long walks in the park and holding hands and stuff like that, you've got to talk about something substantive.
You do.
because it's your life.
That's right.
You know, and the church says you really only get one crack at this.
That is absolutely correct.
And if you are in any way holding back, or if you're working out of fear, or sometimes even in this day and age, I'm kind of surprised that it's just sometimes the pressure from families that, well, this has to happen. And so, no. You, granted, you are marrying into each other's family, but still, you're starting a new one.
Yes.
And so, therefore, you've got to be able to tell them to turn down the volume so that you two can simply talk to each other and listen to each other.
Exactly.
You've got to be able to get used to each other's voice.
Yes.
I tell them that there's a difference between hearing and listening. Hearing is when you're driving in the road and say the radio on, or you're playing a CD or whatever, and just a kind of background music. But all of a sudden, something happens. Maybe it's a news flash, or there's your favorite song from who knows when. You stop hearing and you start to listen to the
Correct.
Song. Well, because it's an act of the will then. I will to do this. I want to listen to this song. Well, that when it comes to your respective lives, you need to be listening to this person for the rest of your life.
And what a challenge.
Oh, yeah. That means you got to put down a sports section.
That's
you got
right.
to turn the TV off. You got to turn the radios off. Maybe you have to walk into another room, get away from the kids that are screaming or whatever, to be able to listen to each other.
Yeah, that's right. Very true.
Because if you're not, you're going to be in trouble.
That's right. This is Deacon Jim Thorndahl. You're listening to Holy Family Radio. I haven't heard of this. I have my guest with me today, Monsignor Edward. Monsignor Edward Hankovich.
Hankovich.
I want to get the Polish pronunciation
proper.
Yes. And he is the vicar general, judicial vicar of the tribunal here in Grand Rapids, Michigan, for the Diocese of Grand Rapids. And we are talking about marriage and decrees of nullity, and we're going to come back. We return to that now. So, as you were saying, Monsignor, we've got to set up in the tribunal where people have a way to come there and try and either reconcile through that, or find out if the marriage can be annulled, correct?
Well, declared null.
Yes.
The term annulment, we have to be very careful about that, because
yes.
that's a civil term, really.
Yes.
What the church is looking at, again, as at the very beginning of their two lives together, when they pronounce those vows, granted they don't know a whole lot of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell them, you're going to be unconscious on that day anyway, so that's why I have to have pictures taken so you remember. But really, you've got to prepare for that way before that day. But you just finally will that when you walk down that aisle, that you are prepared to hand your life over to the other. And because of the wedding day is filled with so much stuff, it's just part of our social, our social system. Every society has those sort of things.
Of course.
But what's interesting about even in the vows, because people, I know in some cases they like the couples to make their own vows, but the church doesn't want that, because there needs to be a real understanding of what it takes to hand your life over to the other. And a lot of language that people might be like being, I remember years ago, I think when Tiny Tim, who was a singer, strange. And he got married on the Johnny Carson show.
I remember that.
To Miss whatever her name was, I can't remember. Anyway, but one of the
Moon star, something I recall that.
Whatever, yeah. And she, and the words, because I think some minister, maybe it was Johnny Carson himself, did the ceremony. And one of the words was to not be puffed up.
Right.
And what in the name of heaven does that mean? So the
sounds
church
like a cereal.
Yes. Okay. And you're not marrying the little Pillsbury Doughboy. Okay. So the thing is, the church has got some specific words that need to be said, but more importantly, for them to understand. In fact, it's one of the things they tell couples, in the part of the preparation. And it's this book that I give you has the marriage right in it.
Mm-hmm.
I need you to go and look in the section where it has the vows.
Yes.
And I need you to read those vows and define them.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean? Give an example from what I heard at a marriage encounter gathering many, many years ago. And a man got up and he was talking about his marriage to his wife, and they had a bunch of kids. And they were married, I don't know, maybe about 22 years or so. And they were getting ready, preparing for their 25th anniversary within a few years. And the gentleman had developed a drinking problem. And he was doing these usual things that you know, people who kind of hide it and that sort of stuff, and he really didn't think he had a problem. The family was trying to do its best, but they tried to leave Dad alone, and he had those periods mm-hmm. of time and all that.
Of course.
Well, so the man was now in this sort of this post-acknowledgement period when he admitted that he did have a drinking problem, and he had gone to AA, and his family was going for assistance too. But what led up to it, because he didn't have a problem, and the family really didn't bring it up. Nobody really gave him an encounter with it. It was he mentioned it. One of his teenage children finally wrote him a letter one day and said, "Dad, I'm leaving home because I do not want to watch you kill yourself." Mm. And it finally dawned on him that in those vows, for better, for worse, for richer, poor, sickness and in health, he was dealing with a sickness, and he needed a cure. Yeah. He needed his family at his side. And he finally went sober and all that, and I think it was within maybe 2 years of the 25th, and he said, "I finally understand now, all these years into marriage, what simple words like, you know, for better, for worse, and for sickness and in health really mean."
And some people say it's just words, and I say, no, words are important. They define who we are many times.
And, absolutely. Yeah. And as far as the vows themselves, or even it's a signature on a marriage license.
Yes.
Well, it's just a signature, you know.
Just a piece of paper.
Yeah, you can do whatever you want. Consider, from and I'm not all into, you know, money law or anything like that. Just take two people who walk into a courtroom, and they want to get married by the local judge. They walk into that courtroom, two separate people. They go before the judge, and I don't think there's much of a ceremony there at all. And do you take so-and-so here? And I do. And do you take so-and-so? I do. And I don't know if he slams a gavel down. And, fine, I pronounce you husband and wife. Now, you know, the bailiff and probably the court secretary were the two witnesses,
yep.
And that's it. But when they walk out of that courtroom, they are now husband and wife. The government accepts that.
Yes.
And all they had to say was, "I do."
Yeah.
And they were changed. They may not think about it, but the church does it in a sense the same way. As soon as you pronounce those words, you are changed, whether you acknowledge it or not. And you can't say, "Oh, I didn't mean it."
Do you know, Monsignor, sometimes when I'm doing a homily for a marriage, I ask the mother of the groom. Mm-hmm. I say, "How much more would you do for your son's wife than his girlfriend?" And I ask the fathers, "How much more would you do for your daughter's husband than her boyfriend?" And the understanding is just the change of the word.
Sure.
Husband or wife or boyfriend or girl, it's huge. And it carries the connotation of a relationship, of a commitment. And you understand, I would do so much more for the husband or the husband, yeah, or the wife.
My daughter and my son-in-law.
Yes.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
And these are small things, and yet they have an incredible effect if we allow ourselves to understand what it is that we do as human beings.
Yeah.
A signature on a piece of paper. If you do that with a bank, you're going to get a loan, and by Gadfrey, you can't say, "Well, I didn't mean it. Sorry, you signed."
Exactly.
And those are small little things. Those are just things of the world. But the church has the same sort of understanding, though, that you're using conventional terms means that it isn't just what you say with your lips, but what's coming from your heart, what you said from the very beginning. I want to marry you.
I would be remiss if I let the time go by today without going into the decree of nullity itself, because this is where the confusion comes in.
Okay.
And I would just like to have, let's get some understanding of what it means to go through a decree of nullity, and how the church, in her love and her mercy, reaches out to those people to help them through that process.
Okay.
First of all, is there a set fee for an annulment, decree of nullity?
No. This was something that was begun by Bishop Rose quite a few years ago when he was our bishop. And it was a great thing because it takes the whole monetary element out of this. This is a service that the church provides, and there is no fee for this sort of thing. When it is completed, we do send a letter asking the people if they would like to contribute to CSA, because that's where the money comes from,
right,
the office. But outside of that, and... once I was asked by a gentleman who was very upset by the whole process. He did not seek the declaration of nullity, but his former spouse did. And once we gave an affirmative decision, he just screamed at me and said, "How much did her family pay you?" Mm-hmm. I said, "Nothing. Don't lie to me. I read all those books. I know those." I said, no. I don't care what examples you have.
Yeah.
The examples here in the Diocese of Grand Rapids and quite a few, several of them in the in Michigan, there's no charge.
Yes, yes.
You take the money component out of it, so that's one less element there that you can
exactly
see the church is trying to do a, simply an act of mercy.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Now, Monsignor, when we look at a marriage, I know there's two criteria the church looks at on the day of the marriage, and that's, is it valid and is it licit?
Okay.
Give us an understanding of those two terms.
Well, that comes in sense of the performance of the sacrament itself. What does it take to be valid? Well, simply to recite those vows, presuming that people are conscious, that they know what they're doing. Or there could be some other issues. Say they were married before, no one ever said anything, so that would render the exchange of vows invalid because
yes.
they had a previous bond. Liceity is sometimes if the ceremony was not quite right for some reason, it's very difficult to say, but it's a valid marriage but not a licit one. They did something wrong, but that doesn't really invalidate them. That would not invalidate the marriage. Certain circumstantial elements can be taken care of.
Okay.
But when it comes to really just the integrity of the two individuals and handing themselves over and presuming there's nothing else to stand in the way, then it's a valid marriage.
Mm-hmm.
The church teaches that it takes two baptized people to bring about the sacrament of marriage. If one of the parties is not baptized, it may be a holy state.
And they don't have to be a Catholic baptized.
No.
Okay. Just want to clarify that.
But we believe that baptism really is that great step that then brings this sacrament into existence, into the person's not baptized. It's a holy state, but it's not a sacrament because a sacrament can't limp. You can't have half a sacrament. It's a sacrament for you, but it's not a sacrament for you.
Exactly.
Well, it doesn't work that way. But nonetheless, even if two parties, one is not baptized, are married in the Catholic Church, and then that marriage, for some reason, you know, does end. It's still, the church looks at it as a valid bond,
okay.
Not necessarily sacramental, but a valid bond that we have to investigate, and that's
and that would be a formal. That would be a formal.
Yes,
okay.
And I think
formal.
We'll just stick to formals for this session, but. What we do is we try to invite both of the parties to participate in this endeavor. They provide all the background information, but then we have a lot of questions. The question is who were they mm-hmm. when they got married that day?
Right.
And that takes their entire background. What kind of background did they live in?
Yes.
One of the things that we see today is that people are coming out of sometimes not the best of family environments.
A lot of disorder.
There's a disorder. If a particular individual is we'll pick on the guys here sort of thing, it's not fair. But, you know, if a guy is used to seeing his parents constantly fighting,
yeah.
a lot of abuse, that sort of thing, and he falls in love with some lady, will he change and he won't be like his dad or his mom? It's hard to say. A leopard doesn't change his spots.
That's right.
Human beings can. That's the great thing. We have a free will. We can learn something else. We can, and oftentimes people say, well, I don't want to be like my parents.
But we tend to emulate what we see.
We do anyway.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, when it comes to alcoholism, it's a little small thing sometimes, but for some reason, some individuals will say, well, no, I never would marry an alcoholic.
Yeah.
But they're living in that kind of environment can lead them to feel so bad about themselves that ultimately they do marry an alcoholic because they feel, well, I'm not good enough to have anybody else for a spouse. Well, that kind of attitude really shakes the ground on which that marriage has begun. And you can have all those sorts of things, attitudes towards children.
Yes.
Sure, I want kids. Of course I do. But then all of a sudden they get married. Well, no. I mean, I just told that to the priest. I mean, you know, he wants us to talk about kids, but I don't want kids. I don't want rugrats running around. I don't want a tricycle stuck in the driveway, sandboxes in the backyard. Exactly. No, sorry. I've got to have my stuff.
Yeah.
And that's another thing. When we talk about some of the elements of marriage.
Yeah, another Monsignor came up for me was I had a friend call, and his daughter, who was planning to get married in the church for the second time, caught her fiancé in looking at a lot of pornography.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's becoming more and more of a problem in our society today. And it wasn't just once in a while. It was mm-hmm. becoming an addiction.
Sure.
And I think they finally realized until this was corrected, that marriage could never take place because the dignity of the marriage would be...
Well, the dignity of the human person, yeah. Plain and simple.
Exactly.
I mean, I've read a couple of articles about the whole business of it's an epidemic in our country. Mm. The availability...
Think about men.
This whole business of pornography, it's available any place, especially now in the privacy of one's home.
You can carry it in your pocket and in your phone.
Yeah, and all it's doing is just destroying the dignity of the human person, the human body.
Yeah.
And you cannot help but be moved by that.
Yeah.
You can't say, well, that's only on the screen. They're only acting. And so, therefore, you know, there's no big deal because this is a real person. We are shaped so much by our social media.
Exactly.
And that's just another little element of causing sort of, well, we would say they cannot bring marriage about because they are so filled with this other sort of approach towards human dignity.
And how would that other spouse ever feel worthy because they're always, their expectations is what they're seeing and not the reality of who the person is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Another thing I think from our perspective, and that is if we speak about infidelity, when I talk with couples, I just don't mean the infidelity of, you know, having sex with someone outside the marriage or whatever. That's sort of the most sort of brutal infidelity, the sort of the attack on the marriage bond.
Right.
But there's another form of infidelity that's very prevalent in our society, and that is people collect a lot of stuff.
Oh, yes.
And it's amazing. I'll never forget, this was quite a few years ago, chatting with a couple, and they had one major problem as they were preparing for marriage. And I said, well, what is it? And I said, well, we don't know what to get each other for our wedding day. And they said, well, everybody else is going to give us gifts, so we have to give presents to each other. And I said, I would have thought, forgive me for being so naive, but I would have thought the best gift that you would offer each other would be yourselves.
Yes.
And there was a whole problem about just how much stuff they were collecting and bringing into the marriage.
Yeah.
Some individuals are so much into electronics and computer stuff or just collecting. Americans are great for developing hobbies, collecting angels or stuffed dolls or hubcaps or cars mm-hmm. or whatever. And those things can become so overreaching in an individual's life that all of a sudden they see the world really as a huge supermarket, and all of a sudden the person that they thought meant so much to them at the beginning of their lives are kind of irrelevant.
You know, Monsignor, it's funny. We were talking about the sex and outside or in the marriage, and one of the questions we ask, obviously, as a premarital test is privately we ask them, are you capable of sexual intercourse?
Yes.
A wedding must be consummated. A marriage must be consummated, correct?
It is expected, yes.
Yes, of course. And why is that?
Well, because that's part of the whole process of the total giving of themselves to each other.
Yes.
They're handing their lives, which includes their bodies,
yes.
over to each other. And then, of course, the other teaching of the church with regard to procreation education.
Yeah.
That act is meant to be open to life.
Yes.
And every so often a couple tell me, well, we're planning on maybe two. And I say, wait a minute. You're planning. I think there's somebody who's even bigger than you two that is involved with life.
Exactly.
You know, leave that to God. If you don't trust God, then do you really trust each other? Because
that's a great statement. Because that, in reality, not to have trust in a loving Father who wants the best for His people.
I think Fulton Sheen, I've never read the book, but I've heard the title. I think he said three to get married. It was a book that he wrote. And three takes three. The man, the woman, and God inviting him into this marriage. And from a theological perspective, it's something that I always tell couples. You need to invite God in.
Yes.
If you're not going to church, if you're not praying, then there's going to be a problem here because you're not inviting the most important one into your lives. He gave you life. Now he wants you to participate in his great act of Genesis.
Monsignor, I know in a formal case when you're doing an investigation on a marriage, I mean, there's quite a bit of paper. Somebody has to really sit down and diligently fill out the questionnaire because it is thorough, it's investigative, and it really is meant to come to the heart of where the problem might lie. So once they do that, I mean, they really just hand it over to the tribunal.
True.
And you take over.
But the first person that they need to see is their local parish priest.
Okay.
Okay. And he will work with them. There are quite a few parishes in the diocese now in which we have trained lay people to help them because some, you know, the priests are very busy. It's only, for the most part, it's only one priest per parish.
Right.
He doesn't have the time. And so we're trying to educate people, train specifically to help people walk them through this process.
Yeah.
And we get some walk-in traffic in the tribunal besides, but I always tell people when I've had contact with them, not just my own people from my own parishes, but look, if you have a problem, you know, you call us, and we will walk you through this.
Yeah.
Because it can be very daunting.
It can.
You know, you've got 150 questions. Oh, my gosh. What am I going to do?
So and they're not yes and no.
No. No, that's the thing. Because we're looking for substantive answers.
That's right.
That really say something about who you are and who your former spouse was.
And, of course, a lot of times I hear people say, oh, my spouse won't respond to this. And I said, well, that in and of itself could be an answer.
True. But we have to really find that other person to give some insight. I would say maybe about a quarter of cases at least, if you can get both parties to answer, they're very honest.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons we also do this is because we want to get people back into the church.
Yes.
Because if you marry outside the church, then you have disenfranchised yourself from the Catholic community. You cannot participate in the sacraments until the church looks at your previous marriage, and then you can celebrate the new marriage, if that's the case, in the church.
Exactly.
Divorce does not cut you off from the church, but a remarriage outside the church can.
Exactly. And I've told many people that also, that, you know, just because you're divorced doesn't mean you can't receive the sacraments, but you have to be very careful, because if you're in another relationship, you have to be sure that you're sacramentally free to move forward.
Yes.
And if you want to remain a practicing Catholic.
Well, that's the thing.
Yeah.
And what we find and experience for the most part in the United States, people are very desirous of remaining with their local Catholic community.
Yeah.
And that's why we do this. We've got a lot of criticism that the United States does more declarations of nullity than any other country in the world. That's because the people of this country are really serious about their faith, even when their marriage collapses.
Yeah. You know, and I would say you're exactly right, because many of them just go and get remarried and continue to go to the church.
Yes.
And they don't understand the harm they're causing.
But they want to belong.
Yeah.
And that's why the tribunal exists.
Yeah. And the tribunal, you know, it's not just a bunch of people sitting around a table talking about this case. I know there's a lot of prayer that goes on and discernment on these cases,
true? Yes. In fact, in the statement that we write, that when we make the decision, it says, in the name of the Lord, mindful of, you know, God watching what we're doing here, you know, and then we go in and then make the case and the arguments and all the rest.
It's really a very pastoral way for a person to remain in the church and in love with the sacraments, to receive the sacraments, and be free again to marry if they go through the process. And if it's awarded, if it's a declaration of nullity is said to be.
Yes. And it is something that we take very seriously. But again, after 30 years of doing this, sometimes it's kind of difficult, but we do find people who will come back and say, you know, you don't know who I am, but you did my marriage case 15, 20, 25 years ago, and I recognized my mistakes, and that process really helped clear things up so I can enter into a new marriage.
But Monsignor, my kids will be illegal.
Oh, simply a declaration of nullity has no civil effects. This has nothing to do, because we get letters all the time and phone calls. What have you done to my grandchildren? We have not done anything to your grandchildren.
That's right.
There, no civil effects here.
Okay. So They're legal children. They're listed. They're your children, and they're
the divorce doesn't do anything to their right. status. So then the Declaration of Nullity is not either.
Exactly, but that's always been one of the things in the back of people's minds. And that, yeah. I'm glad we could clarify that because my hope is through this conversation that whoever Catholics are listening that might be considering thinking about a declaration of nullity for their past marriage, or if they're going through a divorce, unfortunate, that they would sacramentally think about, that they would be thinking about the sacrament they entered into and what it means to really reconcile with the church.
Reconciliation, very important. Yeah. That's what this is all about.
Yeah, and I see that as a vital growth in our church. And I think if we do a better job in training and teaching our young people who are considering marriage, we can lead them down that altar in a much better place.
We hope and pray that we can. Yeah. Ultimately, it's up to them, but the church will do her part.
Exactly. Now, I have to say, tell you something, Shereen, if we talk about words, I grew up in a Catholic and a Greek Orthodox household. And my mother and father were married in a Catholic church. But on the 25th anniversary, my mom asked, would you consider being like doing our marriage again in a Orthodox church? It was for my mother's edification, her mom and everything else.
Okay.
But in a Greek wedding, there are no words spoken. They wear a veil. Each one wears a veil on their head. It's like a little ribbon that goes around, and the ribbon connects to the bride and the groom. Hmm. And they are preceded around the altar three times with the priest reading the vows and incensing and doing the prayers in the cantry and the chanting. Hmm. And that is the wedding.
Well, but that society understands that.
Yes.
So therefore, when you participate in that, you're throwing yourself into it.
That's right.
Okay? And again, it's always the two people that marry each other.
That's right.
The priest is the witness.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, too, because I've told the people I'm preparing, I said, you actually will be the one that will bring the efficacy of the sacrament to one another.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. And that's the only sacrament that's true on that, isn't it?
That's true. Otherwise, you need a minister for it.
Yes.
A priest, a deacon, a bishop.
Yes.
But in marriage, it takes those two people. They are marrying each other.
Yes. Now, if I could ask Monsignor, how many cases are going on right now in the diocese? Because you have any idea?
We're doing about, it seems to me, about 150 formal cases a year, and about 150 of other kinds of cases. We can't go into that today. The numbers are down from what they used to be. We were doing closer to about a total of 600 cases a year.
Okay.
It's less because a lot of people are not getting married. They're just living together or whatever. But the case load still continues.
Can it also be, and I hope and pray it isn't, but the Catholics who are going through divorce aren't bothering to get a decree of nullity?
That's true. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so it's a little bit of a two-edged sword on that, and with the numbers being down sometimes.
Oh, yes. Well, we know that. And there's a lot of social stuff that's going along with that that produces those numbers. But in our diocese, what we still see is people very serious about their faith.
Yeah.
And yes, they'll go through it. It may be painful, but they want to remain connected to the Catholic Church.
Exactly. You know, it's painful, but it's also healing, because some of the things that they never considered or thought about are flushed out.
Exactly.
And some of those things that they need to really be prayerful about, they can bring it to the Lord. And, you know, I see that all the time with these painful marriages. And the Church's position really is to let's pastorally get them back to the Church in love.
Exactly.
And that they can come back and presume and resume a normal life again.
The other thing is, though, because the Church is involved, we're talking about order in the Church. You just can't make up your own rules as you go along.
Yes.
That leads to chaos. I mean, you can't have that in the world in which we live, and the Church is the same way.
Yeah.
The laws are there for the sake of order, not clamping down on people, but making sure that everybody, in a sense, is following the same sort of path, ultimately, to holiness.
Yeah. You know, I read a cute article that said that in terms of secular terms of lawyers, it said there's 30,000 laws on the books to enforce the Ten Commandments.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And so when you think about it, it's an amazing procedure.
It's because we human beings are always looking for other ways to wiggle around the law.
That's right. Monsignor, I want to thank you for being here. I think we've made some clarity on the Declaration of Nullity and really the understanding of marriage, what it really means to be enter in a sacramental relationship. And if we continue to do our jobs, perhaps we can really just keep our families together and loving couples and spouses who get together in these beautiful relationships. So again, thank you for all your hard work. I know that you've been doing this for 30 years, you said?
Yes.
30 years by the grace of God. And you still have a smile on your face. We appreciate it, and as always, we give all praise to Jesus Christ for all that we have and all that we do. And I want to thank all our listeners of Holy Family Radio for listening. This is Deacon Jim Thorndahl, and I wish you God bless.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Living the Catholic Life with your host, Deacon Jim Thorndahl, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Thank you for listening.